to try and come up with a guide for contemporary music and to show you where it's gone, I thought it might be best to just do a little bit in terms of a chronology so that you could see where music, how it got where it is now. The other factor that brings this chronology into play is that up until the 20th century, you really had a pretty well-defined group of rules that you had to work within. The rule today is the sky's the limit, but that was not the rule 100 years ago or 200 or 300 years ago. If you wanted to compose music, that's great. And everybody, by the way, that was one thing we mentioned yesterday, you know, in the period of Bach, a composer was not the exception, that was the rule. Everybody who was in music was a composer. That was taken for granted. Now, what instrument you played was the exception, but that you composed, absolutely, everybody composed. You know, it'd be like walking up today to some music teacher in high school and saying, well, what did you compose this week? You know, they'd probably fall over. Composed this week? When? Ever? I didn't compose anything. But, you know, 200 years ago, obviously they composed. That was the thing you did. I mean, that was just taken for granted. That was like breathing or eating. You composed. And when the composers did this composing, of course, what they ended up doing is they followed a very strict rule. Now, what marked the genius was, could he make the rules fit him? Now, you take a Bach. Now, we go through and look and see that, you know, Bach was given, you know, a rule. All right. So here's, you know, a biggie rule. Rule number one. This piece, Bach decided it's going to be in 4-4 time. Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1. Well, one of the rules of music up until the 20th century was, once you put that down, you couldn't change. You had to fit all of your rhythms in 4-4 time. But Bach was very smart, because if you go and look at some of Bach's pieces, you'll find they're not in 4-4 time at all. They might say that, but if you go and look at them carefully, you'll see that the accents are all falling on the wrong syllable, you know. He made the bars fit him. So it may go merrily along every 4 beats, there's a bar line. But that doesn't mean that with Bach it always worked that way. He was able to finagle and work around it. Now, not everybody was, and that's where the boring ones set in. You know, oh, some of them, they just go on and on for hours. You know, it's really dull. But he could make this kind of thing work. Well, now we get to the 20th century, and one of the things that ends up happening is that things like this don't have to happen. You don't have to stay within that rule any longer. If you decide that you want to go into 3-4 time right here and only have 3 beats in the measure, you can do that. You can go over here and go into 2-4, and nobody's going to say a peep. That's fine. Doesn't matter anymore. So you see, there's been a whole revolution, and consequently, then somebody who, you know, is trying to follow all these trends goes, what's happening here? You know, I can't put my finger on it. Because, and the reason they can't put their finger on it is that there's more places to put their finger than they've got fingers to put them on. And everything's just sort of gone, you know, to the winds. And you have to try and grab where are the actual, I mean, where are the things that are happening? So let me backtrack now and just bring into play some of the musicians that brought this into play. The first part of the century, obviously the first big effect that music had was the First World War. That's really where we call the beginning of the century in music. Music from the 19th century, you know, you had Beethoven, you know, and all of that came on. And then you had Wagner, and that added on. And what all of that did is increase the harmonic sense, that you went from, you know, very standard kind of things. You might get into Brahms. In Wagner, you might get into, you know, you just keep adding on a few tones, but you're still talking about harmonic music. And, you know, and it always resolved. Resolving means it always, it's, you know, there's a point at which you're leading towards that it ends. That was always a key factor until the 20th century. Resolution, you know. You know, there. But it would not end this way. Never. I mean, that would, you know, no. You know, come on, you've got to stop someplace. It's got to end. You know, it's like playing a game and, you know, let's always get back to goal on Monopoly. You know, let's find out where we're going. Let's end there. Let's do something. So this was always one of the problems that confronted the 20th century person who said, I don't want it to end there. So after the First World War, when things went to the wind, you had the first reaction to this. And the first reaction would be impressionism. Art kind of goes along the same lines. Impressionists said that this whole thing, we call this music getting chromatic. Chromatic is when you go all the notes that are on the piano, in other words. That's a chromatic scale. This is a diatonic scale. Chromatic. All the tones are used. And chromatic music just, you know, gets to be things like, as opposed to, and it became, they said, what, we can still play in the keys, but why can't we just have more, why can't we have a greater degree of, we can impress, we can make impressions, you know, like things like, chromatically going down the scale. I was just going, but that wouldn't have been done in the 19th century, except that Wagner, you see, had kind of been pulling this whole thing. So it's like, how far can we spread out? How far can we keep and still call it tonal music? Well, you had a whole group. You had Debussy. You know, I'm wrong key, sorry. Impressionistic kind of piece of music. And a whole group. You had Dukas. You remember, well, what's the piece? Very early Walt Disney film. Sorcerer's Apprentice. Music by Dukas. And D-U-K-A-S. And there were a number of composers, mainly French, that worked on this whole impressionistic thing. And this was a reaction to romantic music, romanticism. And at the same time, you had a furtherance of romantic music in Germany with Richard Strauss. Richard Strauss wrote an opera. A couple of things that set the world on its ear talking about music were a piece called Salome that he did early on. Because, you know, all of a sudden in the middle, this woman danced the Seven Veils dance, you know, and woo-hoo, I mean, it was a big routine, you know, and they'd forgotten that 50 years earlier there'd been another opera that did the same thing. But Strauss was one of these kind of people who just advanced this whole thing as far as he could. And that kind of school has kept on. There has been, Ravel continued it a little bit later. But there were some people who felt that Impressionism was just, and it was, an advanced form of romanticism. And it just, you know, you're still talking about keys. And consequently, you came to another group that was actually born in about the next generation that included three very distinct names, Schoenberg, Webern, and Baer. The father of the school, and the name that he's, you know, one of the great minds in music for the 20th century, was Schoenberg. Because what he did was to completely say that music, and now we get, well, let me go back 1 minute so you can hear. Here's the end of Romanticism. Here's Richard Strauss. Here's Richard Wagner doing Tristan and Isolde. That is music that you would say is, it was written in the key. It was written in the key of A minor. All put down very carefully, but it's chromatic. That is, you know, it's kind of, you could go anywhere. You know, after you've done this, well, I could go here if I wanted to, or there if I wanted to. There's a number of places I could take this thing. And he did. In fact, one of the things about that piece that's so fantastic is that he never resolves it to the actual, to the very end of the opera, 4 hours later. And he uses that motif about 100 times. He goes all over the place. It never stops. It keeps going. And it's not till the end of the third act that he finally, you know, you go, oh, you know, it's a wonderful moment when it happens. But he uses that motif. Well, I don't mean it in that sense. I mean, it's wonderful that he resolves it, too. But that kind of stretching of chromatic, of what we call the sense of chromatic music, was the thing that finally it reached a point where Schoenberg said, no, if you've gone that far, then you have said that every tone of the 12, there are 12 tones in music, 12 basic tones before you start repeating yourself. If you start at C and go on up, you'll have 12 notes before you hit another C again and just repeat the whole process. So we're dealing with 12 tones, and he said, actually, then what you're talking about is that all 12 are of equal importance, or they should be of equal importance. And if they're of equal importance, you no longer have key centers. By key centers, this is a bit complex, but it's very important to understanding 20th century music, because a ton of what has come out of Hollywood in film scores all derives from all of this. That's why I'm spending time on it. When he said this, what he was referring to is that before that time, everything had a key center. Everything was written in a key. This will be in the key of C. This will be in the key of A. In the key of G flat. But it was always in a key. Everything had a key center, so that you always ended up, it was like that chord I played. You know, you always would resolve it to F major, or someplace, but you didn't leave it. You didn't say that in itself was a key. You went, no, it had to get here. So that you have a key center. Now, if you have, let's take C major. If you have a key of C major, well, you actually have all those notes. Some of them are more important to C major than others are. Obviously, I'm playing three right here. C, E, G, and those are the most important notes to C. C is most important, and E and G are important. F's kind of important, and, you know, and A. F-sharp's not quite as important. And there becomes a whole system that you can figure out of which ones are more important and which are less important. But he says, if you're going to be dramatic, and you can do that same pattern in any key, he says, then you have to start saying that all the notes are of equal importance. And if all the notes are of equal importance, then you want to detach the notes from the base of reference, that is, from a key, from saying it has to go somewhere. And you want to suppress the difference between the notes as far as which is more important than any other. So now you say, if you are Schoenberg, that all notes are equal. That no matter what you do, you are equal on the piano. And consequently, you're not talking anymore about dissonance and consonance. This is called consonance, according to what we commonly think of. Say, if we were singing a hymn, this would be a consonant. This would be a dissonance. But you see, Schoenberg said, if all notes are equal, that's as consonant as this is. Because you're not talking any longer about key centers. Then he went on from there and said that you had, what you were talking about is that there are two kinds of tonality in the world. There's tonality in which all chords lead to a perfect chord. And if we're in the key of C, that means that if I play this chord, it's not an end in itself. It's got to go towards, oh good, there we are, back home again. You know, or if I got this chord going, whoops, I've got to get home. There we go. All right, now we're back home again. And we always keep running back to C, if that's the key we're in. That's one kind of tonality. The other kind of tonality is the kind that says, whatever group of notes you put together on a piano, well, let's take these four, okay? I duplicated myself. There we go. Those have now formed a chord. And by themselves, they are tonal. There it is. It's its own key. Now, as soon as I play the next one, we're in another key. But we're not in keys of like C major. They just form their own key. There's a key, and we keep on going. And as soon as you start adding all of those together, it becomes atonal, because you can't distinguish keys any longer. So you have tonal music and atonal music. And you could sort of, if you want to make a very loose comparison, think of tonal music and poetry. And think of atonal music and prose. Now, there's a lot of exceptions, but basically, you see, tonal music goes for the key center the way a lot of poetry goes for the need of a rhythmic following of the line, you know, like Longfellow, or you can think of any number of poets that need that particular rhythm to make it work. In prose, you're linking an idea in relation to your mind, you know, rather than thinking in terms of a specific rhythm that's got to follow along. And atonality follows the same kind of idea. It's a very kind of complex thing, but If you have ever listened, and most of you I'm sure have, to any of the TV shows that use atonal music, like, I don't watch television, so I'm no good at this, but any of those really good suspense weekly ones.
How about
ones.
Star Trek?
All right, Star Trek does. And there's another one that I've seen once or twice. I don't remember it. Here's where I'm in trouble. Thank you. I've seen that. Yeah, any of those kind of pieces use atonal music, and they're all derived from Schoenberg. Now, what Schoenberg did was furthered in a guy like Webern, and then followed up with Berg, who was sort of the final one. And as I say, it's a bit complex, perhaps, to grasp something you really need to for following the whole trend of music, because then anything else that comes out of it, like folk music that comes, is a reaction to atonalism. All right. So, you know, they did some wonderful things, like the piece of atonal music that you really ought to hear sometime, the first time you hear it, it might just blow your mind, but then you go back to it and say, you know, hey, I want to figure out what it's all about, is an opera called Wurzeln. It was the supreme example of atonal music by Alban Berg. Wurzeln was the setting of a 19th century play by Buchner. And the music, what Berg took, and he wrote the whole piece in atonal style. He tried to create an atmosphere for the music, an atonal atmosphere, not an atmosphere like, say, Racine or something like that, but think of it more like, say, Dostoevsky. And he wrote so that when he did things coming up the scale, like, you know, the whole third act is just enough to, you know, if you understand what's happening, you can barely make it through the third act. It's just really an incredible piece. It doesn't make an effect on the piano because it's the instruments that make the interesting effect too. In the third act, when he goes out and unfortunately drowns in the quicksand, in the bog, and the sound of the atonal use of the mists rising up from the bog as he goes down in is just absolutely overwhelming. I mean, you know, there's nothing else like it. You could not have achieved that by going. It just isn't. It is not the same thing. And it's all in strings, they're going up in low clarinets, and it's just absolutely overwhelming. And then at the very end, when the children are gathered about, and of course the whole thing at the end, when the children are gathered about, and Wurzeln had a little boy about 2 years old, and who doesn't understand that his father's been killed, and all the kids come running in and say, hey, somebody just drowned in the bog, and the whole thing at the end. And the super imposing of a kind of a deathly sense with chords, you know, that are against this little boy who's sitting there on this little hobby horse going, hop, 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 hop. As the curtain comes down, it's just, you know, completely wipes you out. And of course, it's also fascinating to hear people go to the opera and have no idea what it's going to be. That's wonderful, you know. They come with their names and they're, oh, this is going to be wonderful. And the opening chord comes in. Whoa, wait, you know, what happened? And you know, it's really fascinating because some people are just, you know, I mean, they're so overwhelmed. But it's like anything else. You know, we are only, our ears have been trained to say this is a lovely sound and this is a not nice sound. But if our ears had been trained the reverse, you know, think of how marvelous the reverse would be. I mean, you know, it could be not marvelous, but fascinating to think that this was a nice sound and this was dissonance. You know, now you're talking about something completely reversed, and there's no reason. And of course, that's the way Webern felt. Now, a lot of other peripheral things happened at the same time. You can have like a Mio that did polytonal music. Polytonal just means two tones at once, so that you dealt with, say, this going at the same time this is going. So you have, which was also used by Honeywell when he wanted to write a piece about a train. You know, the same thing here is polytonal music against. That's just two groups of two chords on top of each other. That's not atonal, that's polytonal. So you have another, you know, you have a whole third group. This gets, it, you know, it gets into a lot of little fields that become splinters off from there. Yeah,
Isn't there something about the frequencies of the different tones in the chord that make it dissonant as opposed to, you know, what happens with the sound waves that come out of the different tones that make it either dissonant or consonant?
Yeah, you can get into, you can get into partials of tone that can make variances for you as well. But don't, let's not get off on that yet, because that's another, when we get to electronic music, I'll come into that. But that area can, you know, I like to think of it more as like I know some sopranos who sing, you know, consonantly and sing dissonantly, depending on their pitch sense, you know. That, you know, we've all heard, you know, it's interesting, if you listen to somebody sing, you are much more likely to allow yourself to listen to somebody sing a little sharp than a little flat. If they sing a little flat, you're always going like this, you know. And if they're a little sharp, you're kind of, yeah, okay, yeah, you know, doesn't sound quite right, but you don't, it's not as easy to put your finger on if somebody's singing sharp as it is flat. Flat, you actually, you know, you go bananas. You know, you say, oh, okay.
In your example of orchid, as an atonal kind of a nightmare, really weird, bad kind of thing, that's fine. But can you give a counterexample of an atonal thing in which everybody's very happy and jolly?
Oh, in Webern. Oh, in Webern. Webern was determined that the atonal music would be all joy. But he, but the problem, again, that I have with the piano is that when Webern wrote his joyful pieces, they're all very short. You know, brevity was his word. And everything he wrote, it was like little droplets of water. You know, I mean, it was atonal in the sense of being that kind of thing. And he treated, again, that might have been, say, two clarinets and a violin. He would treat all of this kind of thing very, very much in a sense of trying to get a mood of uplift to what he was doing, as opposed to it being a, what's that, kind of depression. A lot of this was very organized because they realized they had 12 tones to deal with. So you write what they call the 12-tone system, or a row. A row is simply to take 12 tones and then use them as the basis for your composition. Now, the row might be, but that's kind of uncreative, you know. And it's, this is also mathematical too. You know, those of you who are, you know, real wild about, you know, getting into mathematical probabilities, you know, 12-tone music is, you know, pick up a piece of 12-tone music and analyze it. It's fantastic how this has all worked out. So that, you know, there comes the usual criticism that 12-tone music is not music, it's mathematics. But then I could say the same thing about Bach and about every other composer, because there is a degree in which this has all been worked out somewhat mathematically. 12-tone music will make up a row and say, here's our row. There's a Schoenberg row in the back of this book here. Let me play you a row. Here's a row. He made up. I won't ask you to sing it back. But that's all 12 notes without repeating any of them. Now that's the basis for your piece. Now you can use them in chords. You can use the first three notes in a chord. You might not use them in that way. You might put the second one down an octave and go. Maybe you only use two. Maybe you'll do it in retrograde. Retrograde means start at the back and go up to the front. There's any number of ways. I mean, there's like, I don't know, 400 ways you can redo it and still have it work. You can start in the middle and go out. You start from one end and go in the middle this way and come that way. There's all kinds of ways, but all of it involves what they call perfect 12-tone writing. And many composers are challenged to write a piece that's, you know, 12-tone in nature. Some of you who live in the cities may have seen or heard about an opera called Postcard from Morocco that we did at Minnesota Opera last year by Dominic Argento. And Argento was determined to write a 12-tone romantic opera, which is possible, which means, you know, everybody thinks of 12-tone music and everybody thinks of, you know. But he said no. And so he wrote, following all the rules of 12-tone writing, an opera in which it was wonderful, because people came up to me and they could not, they would not believe that it was 12-tone. It can't be, because I liked it. You know, I said, oh, but it is. And you go through, and he wrote it on two rows. He developed two different rows, and they are used. He wrote it on two rows because it's concerned about a fellow who wants to go to sea. And that was, it's true, you know. And that's why I did it on two rows. And the whole thing is completely based, and it's incredible. And you go through and study it. The singers didn't know. You know, some of them had no idea. And until you start pointing it out and say, here's the row. They go, oh, you're right. Good grief. You know, and it became so very tonal to them that they couldn't believe that such a thing could be a piece of atonal music, or a piece of 12-tone music, and yet it was. So it's very fascinating. You can mold that any way you want. Well, that's only one facet that went on. And I don't want to just spend the whole time on that. At the same time that you had this great break with tonality, you had a great break with rhythm. And the man most responsible for the break in rhythm is Stravinsky, more than any other. Because until the time that he started to write, people were still pretty much with your basic 4-4 and stick with that for the whole piece. Stravinsky said, or felt, that the big thing that bar lines, you know what I mean by bar lines, you know, in music, you're merrily going along every, you know, all right, so we're in the treble clef, and you know, we're merrily going all of a sudden, rock, we got one of those, and we go a little further, and whoosh, we got another one. That never existed before Baroque music. They never had that. Because what happened is that as soon as you put bar lines in, the first note, those of you who sing or read music know, the first note after every bar line, it becomes the downbeat and goes, whoosh, real heavy. And so you can never have a heavy accent except on the downbeat. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3. You know, how can you write a piece of music and say, I want 4 to be the accent this time? 1, 2, 3, 4, 1. You know, I mean, you can't. You know, so you're stuck. You're really into a mold that you can't get out of. And 19th century music was the worst of all. It really limits you. It means that your accent is always going to be on the first beat. Oh, sure, you can write a fourth beat with a little accent over it. But no matter whether you do that, one still gets all kinds of power. And he said, let's get rid of that. And all you simply do is by saying that the meter can change. And so what he would do is write pieces of music that wouldn't necessarily have a meter. And if he wanted to write like he did in Rite of Spring, when he had the rhythm of... pagan dance, which he didn't feel was so pagan if you always went. I mean, it always sounds just so pagan after a while. But how much more, you know, savage when it's irregular? Hard to play, too. But, you know, but that's beside the point. The point is it takes on a much more savage kind of feeling when it's irregular in rhythm. And that whole kind of thing came about with Stravinsky. Others, I mean, you know, emulated and copied him, but he basically was very concerned about this whole thing. Honegger made an interesting point that I read in here about Stravinsky. Honegger was a Swiss composer who lived in the, died about 1945. He was concerned because Honegger wrote a piece of music that was called King David, and he wrote it after the First World War. And he had unusual resources. This little town wanted him to write a piece celebrating the end of the war, and he thought the story of King David would be very good. And they said, well, that's great, and here are your resources. You've got 100 singers and 15 instruments, and we can't get any more, and they're all wind instruments. You know, clarinets, flutes, and trumpets, trombones, you know, that's it, here they are, and here's the chorus, and, you know, we're looking forward to your composition. Be lovely. And he happened to run into Stravinsky, who not only was the master at the rhythm, but it was the master of just taking odd groups of instruments. And he said, you know, what am I going to do? I told him the trouble I was having, balancing a chorus of 100 and an orchestra of 17 musicians. And Stravinsky said, oh, it's simple. Think as if you had wanted that disposition and composed for 100 voices and 17 musicians. And Honegger says, this might seem oversimplified, but his reply gave me an excellent lesson in composition. To accept the thing given, not as a thing imposed, but as a personal starting point and an inner necessity. Hence, to begin with the sonorous material and to know what music and what technical combinations can be extracted from it. And King David, in that version, is one of the most gorgeous pieces of music I have ever seen written for, you know, for a limited means. He later redid it for full orchestra, and it's not as good. The really good piece is the early one. It's just amazing, given that limitation of just those wind instruments, which, you know, you kind of think of like a band kind of thing, only very chamber inside, just small. It's absolutely fantastic what that man could do. The combinations of instruments, not only the combinations, but where they played. You know, like having a bassoon that normally you think of as a low instrument playing in its high register, and putting a flute that usually plays in its high register in its low, so that the bassoon is playing above the flute, is an unusual kind of sound that you don't often hear. And he used those kind of combinations of things, and it's actually a gorgeous piece of music. And it's those kind of people that influenced everything that came up on later with American music, because it all went from there. One other thing about meter, a quote that Stravinsky said, he was talking about meter, and he said, you know, I race with, when I say meter, the whole business of rhythm, of you know, how many beats you're going to have in a measure. He said, I race with my meter. My greatest joy is to feel myself master of my race. I run like a well-oiled machine. And he really did. He did everything with rhythm that, you know, it was, of course, told that it was unplayable, just like everybody said that when Beethoven wrote the Ninth Symphony, you know, it couldn't be played, and it was impossible. And it was the same thing when the Rite of Spring came out. Enormous scandal. Just, you know, huge scandal. People said, this is not music. This is, well, it's noise. Not music. That whole routine, this couldn't be music. And there was a huge fight the opening night. Oh, I wish we had more fights in music. I thought there were tomatoes on the whole routine. I was in San Francisco a couple years ago and met a fellow, older gentleman, who was at the first performance. And he was for many years organist and choir master at St. Bartholomew's in New York. And we happened to be talking about, he had studied in France with Vidor and Pierre and other people. And I said, yeah, and he said, yeah, I was at that opening night. I said, really, what was it like? Oh, you know, it was kind of wild. But, you know, they really make it up to be much more than it was in the books. You know, I mean, you know, it wasn't that wild. You know, there's a few tomatoes going and people yelling and screaming, you know. We had to stop for a while and then we started again. But he said, you know what was more exciting to me? He said, you know, I got to sit in this box and right next to me was Puccini and Debussy. And I was just amazed. I said, imagine that you saw them. Well, that's so amazing. But think they were sitting together. And you kind of go, ouch, you know, oh, yeah, that's true. Because they were completely different styles. But, you know, here's this man and carrying on that way. It's fantastic. Well, Stravinsky was not only the master of rhythm, he was also the master of taking music composition and moving it further. But basically, the 20th century brought into its play sort of the rule that said anything goes. And in addition to what we've mentioned, 12 tone and expanding the rhythm, you had certain people that, let me just mention some other ideas so you get the whole gamut of what went on. You had people who said, we must develop more of a folk music orientation to our national culture. And so you had like Kodály and Bartók in Hungary, who really were involved with this kind of thing. The same way Vaughan Williams and Holst were involved with it in England. The same way Ives was involved with it in the United States. As far as folk music, he took things like all the old camp meeting hymns. They were folk music and used all of those. You know, his Third Symphony is called the Revival Meeting. And it's just wonderful. Oh, at the end of it, when Just As I Am, Without One Plea comes on top of Joy to the World. Oh, it's wonderful, you know. But if you don't know the hymns, it doesn't mean a thing. Like, well, I'll get into that later. I have a whole big thing about people going to hear Ives and they don't know the hymns. Because, you know, it's like sitting there, you know, okay. And you say, well, that's kind of interesting. And you really don't have the depth to get to it. Because, you know, and somebody else is chuckling away the time we did a personal example. When I was in the symphony and we did a piece of Ives called Decoration Day, about 4th of July. And right in the middle of it comes, Memorial Day. Right in the middle of it comes O Come All Ye Faithful, just blaring forth in the trumpet. And it's a rather long piece, and Skrobaczewski, the conductor who comes from Poland and doesn't know that piece, said it was too long, we'd have to make a cut. And he cut the whole section of O Come All Ye Faithful, the only thing that people in the audience would have recognized. And I went up to him afterwards, you know, fresh, young,
but you know, it was like there's an important section but left out of this piece. And you know, it's not important. I said, well, you know, I beg to differ with you. It happens to be one section that I think people would probably recognize. When Poulenc wrote his piano concerto, and I did it with the orchestra about 6 years ago, in the third movement, he wrote it for an American orchestra. And in the third movement, he does a play upon Way Down Upon the Swanee River. It's not, you know, real, but, you know, it's like when the orchestra starts, you know, and it just enough that you go, uh-oh. And then he goes on. He doesn't, you know, you don't overmake the point. That's always the genius, you know when to stop. You know, some of them wouldn't, you know, they keep going, you know. In the rehearsal, I had said to Stroh, you know, I knew he didn't know that too, and I said, you know, there'll probably be some laughing in the orchestra when they get to the third movement because they don't know the piece, but when it happens, you know, and he can understand it. Yes, it is his music, but it also has to be a very well-known American folk tune, and he said, well, couldn't have that been by coincidence. Yeah, there was somebody else, yes, but not Poulenc. Poulenc always knew how to make a joke, you know. He's the guy who always said, I always want my piano piece to play with the pedal down at the beginning and don't let it up till you get done. Oh, it's like having cooking and not enough butter. All right, so you had that. Then you had quarter tone music. Quarter tone music is halfway between, if you sang G and you sang G sharp, that's what we call a half step. Now, there's a quarter step that's halfway between there. You know, we can all do it. You go like, that's a half step, but is a quarter step. And, you know, that's what we oftentimes hear when we hear some dear soprano singing, you know. Quite up, sweetie, you know, a little higher, you know. You know, we say she's singing flat. Well, what in actuality she's doing is singing a quarter step. She's not singing a full half step in music. And, so a fellow in Czechoslovakia, Alois Abba, who just died this year, must be about 85 when he died, made a quarter tone piano. And it's a big round job, you know. It's got it wouldn't have 88 keys, it'd have, you know, 176 keys. And it's very elaborate. You couldn't do it long, or you'd be in a trap race. And so it was a round keyboard. He was playing like this, you know. Fascinating. And of course, Charles Ives wrote pieces for quarter tone piano. But what he did, he didn't have a piano like that to work from. So Charles Ives simply took had the tuner tune the piano a quarter tone down. You know, oftentimes if you have your piano tuned at home, the tuner might say to you, "Oh, it's just a little down. It's not a half step down." That means it's like a quarter step, or even you can even go more degradations than you can go a 16th of a step or something. But you know, into just variances, you say, oh, the piano's a little flat, we tune it up. Well, I like to have it tuned down. And so like he'd have two pianos, and one would be at one pitch and one would be a quarter tone lower. It's an interesting sound that you get. It's an adventure in sound that goes on. So you had all of these kind of things going at the same time. You had all kinds of other people, like, say, Prokofiev, who was concerned with bringing back folk song more in Russia, but keeping certain of the forms, like the symphony form. A lot of people, you see, like Debussy and Ravel, threw out the forms. They said, I'm not going to write a symphony. I'm just going to write a piece. I'll call it Images, or I'll call it Afternoon of a Pawn. But I'm not going to write a symphony in four movements. And so things became much more free. So that consequently, a composer writing in the 20th century has all kinds of ways in which to choose. The big problem, and it's the problem of every century, not just this one, is always how do you decide what's good? As a listener, how do you decide what's good? They've been proved wrong before. You know, all the folks that said Beethoven was out of it. Or those that said Brahms. Oh, you know, the first time they ever played Brahms, dissonance, people didn't want to hear this. They were used to this, you know. They were used to, we don't think anything of it now. We hear it all the time in any kind of, you know, any pop songs that come out are just filled with anything, you know. Brahms is passé, you know, we've gone beyond that. But, you know, the people at that time, I mean, it was just absolutely, So, you know, let me bring it over to America a little bit. The grandfather of American music is certainly Charles Ives, as far as the 20th century. Ives was one of these wonderful people who wrote music and said, I'm 50 years ahead of my time, and put it away. And he's right. You know, nobody ever played it. Now people are playing Ives, but it's the music he wrote back in 1920 that they're playing. And he simply wrote, he was an insurance adjuster, and made his living, in fact, made a very wealthy living in that. He stopped composing about 1930. He lived till he was still 1954. He won the Pulitzer Prize, you know, way, way late, like about 1950 or something. They finally got around to giving it to Ives. But all of this he had done much, much earlier, and he really did a lot of adventuresome things. You know, we talk about Schoenberg really, you know, being the father of 12 tone music. That's true, except that Ives did it before him by 20 years, back in 1898. Ives was organist at Central Presbyterian in New York, and they asked him to leave. He did hymn variations like I do, only, you know, he went further. I mean, way further. They had trouble with the hymns. They really had trouble, you know. And but he had a wonderful sense of humor. His variations on America are wonderful, you know. But music also at that time with Ivan, he was concerned not only about keeping the culture and expanding. All of these great composers have always felt, you know, you've got to get people's ears to be constantly expanded. You know, we are still doing this, and we always will. We constantly find that our ears are able to accept more in terms of complexity than, say, our grandparents did. And two generations on, you know, it's amazing to think, you know, what's going to be happening? You know, what would they think would be commonplace that we today would say, oh, we feel kind of modern. You know, the ears are constantly, until you get these great composers who are constantly always just a little bit ahead. I'm trying to keep it from going into all kinds of technical terms, because obviously with each of these composers, certain things come into play. Some are more tame than others. Some, like say an Aaron Copland, is equally concerned about American culture, and he was fascinated with like the Shakers in Pennsylvania, from which he got his own song. Took it and made Appalachian Spring out of it. And many composers have, you know, had a more conservative harmonic structure than Ives. Ives' father trained him as a young boy. Let's try this. I'll give you, this is an Ives lesson. When he was growing up, his father said, you must train your ear. It is the most important thing, and our ears don't do one millionth of what they could. And it's true. All right, let's just sing a little bit of My Country 'Tis of Thee, and I'll show you what Ives' father did. You begin, and then I'll play the accompaniment. Ives' father played in a different key than his son sang. Keep your own pitch going. All right, my country, ready?
My country.
Not concerned with that his son necessarily be writing one half step higher. That wasn't it. He was more concerned about developing the ear, you know, hearing things. It's the same way if you go into a music theory class and you learn to do things like if a teacher gives you this, you can then sing it back. You know, obviously you don't start there. You start by... You keep adding on, and pretty soon you know you can learn these kind of things. It's the same way if I were suggesting you to, you know, I think you ought to go out and pick up a copy of Ives' Third Symphony. I think you'd all associate with it because you know the gospel hymns, I think, enough that you'd be able to recognize the ones in there. Shall we gather at the river, just as I am, joy to the world. You know, he uses them very carefully, but it's just wonderful. And at the end, when heaven and nature sing, comes on top of just as I am, really, that ends, this is great. But those kinds of effects that come, I would never suggest to somebody who's never heard Ives, listen to the Fourth Symphony. The Fourth Symphony is just incredibly complex. You've got at one point, at the very beginning, you've got one part of the orchestra going. It's like knowing how you get to something, how you go with it. Church music, I think of all the forms of contemporary music, is the furthest behind. Because it is by far the most conservative. And when church music, it's done a few things. Obviously, reactions like having guitars in church, which I think there's no reason why you can't have any instrument in church. I don't happen to care for the accordion myself, but if somebody wanted to do something with accordion, that'd be fine. I love the saxophone, for instance. I think I've got a piece we're going to do next year for four saxophones and organ. Well, that's lovely. Why not? Why not have any instrument in church? But to say, I think one of the reasons why the guitar became so popular in church was as an overreaction to those people who said, the only instrument that you will have in church is the organ. It is ordained of God that there will be an organ in church. You know, well, it was only ordained as of the 15th century when they knew what an organ was. You know, before then they didn't have them, they had other instruments. And it's always kind of sad to think of a church that says, well, the only one, well, we might allow on Easter a trumpet, you know, because that's really Easter for the trumpet to sound. That would be good to have that in there, you know. The Bible does mention it. But, Christmas Eve, the harp's kind of nice, you know, so we'll let that happen. But that's about it. That's really a shame, because obviously the reaction of the guitar was in part a reaction to that. Unfortunately, what ends up happening oftentimes is the sense, if I'm stepping on toes, I'm really not sorry. So, the reaction then comes is that people go overboard. It's always that way. I mean, it's music like anything else. And they go absolutely bananas over the guitar. And so say, throw out the organ. So now that's really ridiculous. The guitar is a hard time accompanying congregational singing. Why throw out the organ? You can have both. Both can have their place. You know, there's so many wonderful little pieces that you can use. Like, I can't always do it, but I try, like a flute. If there's a piece of music that has an obligato, like say for flute or violin, and let some high school or college person who's got some proficiency on the instrument have a chance to do something. It's a great thing, but you know, just because it's not an organ, many people, we have trouble bringing some of these things in. The sad thing about the guitar is that what ends up happening is that our quote-unquote music educators, some of them don't understand how the guitar even operates that well, get on the guitar bandwagon and then push it beyond where it ought to go in terms of music publishing. And it ends up, you know, that it's been put outside of its own element. And I kind of fear for it in that respect, because then it becomes like you get a reaction against the guitar in church. And that's really sad, because I think it really has a lovely place. And as long as people understand, you know, I think the organ perhaps has been overdone, but then finding out where it fits into it. Then you have a lot of churches, you see, that maybe some of you are not familiar with, but that brought into play the piano, bringing the piano into church, especially like for an evening meeting where they wanted it, they felt the organ was too austere, and brought the piano in as a more comfy, you know, well, we can kind of, you know, let down our hair a little bit and we'll let the piano play. And much of this came as a result of, say, the tent meetings, the revival meetings, in which they didn't have an organ and have a piano there, and they brought it in. And all of this sort of becomes a very kind of hazy area. Another area that's developed out of that is the whole area of music in the church. I've had some experience in this, having been in three denominations as organist and choir director, and it's interesting to see the differences. In one church in which the greatest strictness, it was a very strict church, in terms of social ills, and, you know, obviously dancing, cars, movies, you know, all were forbidden. That is, unless you didn't say anything, you know, but you were supposed to. And consequently, it was very fascinating, and I didn't understand it right at first, to see how they went around or under the wall that supposedly separated secular and religious. Now, all churches, to varying degrees, do this. I think it's unfortunate that there's a wall in the first place, but it's like we talked the first day about hymns. You know, when Luther was around and used all those secular tunes because they had nothing else to start with, you're not going to get a congregation to sing by writing a new tune that they never heard and having the whole hymn book filled with all new ones. You started with things they knew, a drinking ballad, a love song. They just happened to have words associated in some other way. But why can't we then take, as I mentioned the other day, take Hark the Herald Angels Sing and use it to, you know, Sound of Music, you know. The same kind of thing in the 20th century of what they did back in Luther's time. Some people, of course, got very offended, and some people said, well, you know, we have very little recourse. Well, today it's a little different situation, but that same kind of thing applies. Well, what many churches have done is that there is a wall between the religious and secular, and some churches in contemporary music have, with the use of other instruments, and also just with the use of jazzing up what's there, you'd be amazed at how far the quote-unquote religious music has gone. I know a church in which this is one of their numbers. Perhaps some of you who are younger don't know this tune, but the older ones will groan. You know, and the whole routine there. You can use all of that. You can go the same way, and there's a popular song about He Touched Me, and a lot of churches use that and just substitute the word Christ. He touched me. He touched me. You know, and I've got people going, you're kidding. I can't believe it. You know, well, I can believe it. I've accompanied somebody who sang it. I know it happened. You know, but it has to do with a different kind of upbringing and a different feeling about what music is. In some churches, my personal reaction is that some of this becomes a reaction against, since we're not allowed to do certain things, it kind of comes in by another means. And if you say all of Hollywood is bad, and still at the same time you want it, then one way you can perhaps get it is use its music, but just put different words with it, and you've got, you know, the best of both, or the worst of both, or, you know, however you like to look at it. I don't feel that's all true, though, and I'm sure that many people are sincere about it, but I also do know that it's, you know, if you're raised in one kind of culture, it's amazing in both ways. It's amazing to see in another culture what happens. I think Lutherans are... do a great disservice to themselves when someone is has come to the Lutheran church and has to try and follow the order for service. You know, I would like there to be in the front page, good luck. You know, to be going along here and all of a sudden be going along and have options. You know, put the option in another part, you know, make another setting, but don't have this. And then go, in place of the foregoing, the following, maybe. Well, my Lord, somebody new is just, yeah, well, good. And it's a disservice. Now, by the same token, you can go the other extreme. You can have, you know, you could go to a evening service at, say, a Covenant church or to a Pentecostal church, and you might be absolutely amazed. In fact, many of you might be shocked, turned off, I don't know, to see at what they feel is religious music. The gamut is absolutely huge. If you don't know the gamut, go down to a book and Bible house sometime. The music they have in the book and Bible house will not be Bach, I assure you. John W. Peterson is one of the big names. And it, well, it runs the whole gamut. But you'd be very amazed to see there's a whole, I'm saying it, you know, as if, since most of you are Lutheran, from the point of view that you probably haven't experienced a lot of this, but you'd be surprised at how wide the gamut goes from one extreme to the other, from a very kind of rigid, almost forbidding sense, as some people regard the chant, which I think is unfortunate, but maybe I think you'll see something different with it tonight, to the opposite extreme, to a just sort of late 19th century over-lushness, you know, kind of routine with good Gazzandi up and down the piano, and, you know, that's just basically... One kind of extreme. I think that the church, you see, where it's always the most conservative one, is in bringing in, the church has a tendency so often to stay within a very small mold of a kind of music. I think that the church, you see, where it's always the most conservative one, is in bringing in, the church has a tendency so often to stay within a very small mold of a kind of music. And the music that most choirs are still doing in their church is the music that was prominent in the late 19th century. We're always about 50 years behind in music from what was being composed. And that's not to say that it's all good or bad, and sometimes by waiting you can weed out the junk. But at the same time, I think we have lost a certain sense in which we could stimulate our ears. You know, much the way I feel one of my missions, in a sense, at Holden, is to stimulate people to realize that text that they have sung 2 million times can have a new meaning if you just put a different tune to them. We just get stuck in a kind of lethargy. And that same lethargy, you know, can you imagine a Sunday morning of a choir doing something that was really rather contemporary, like I mentioned yesterday, with an electronic tape? Why some people would probably fall over, you know, and they couldn't believe it. But depending on how it was introduced, you know, it's always that. Obviously, somebody else could get up and talk about an electronic piece and turn you so far off you'd never be interested in it. And we, of course, didn't even get this morning into that whole area of contemporary music. There are all of these, that's another extension, is the sounds beyond the sounds that instruments can make, the sounds that electronics can make. That's where the Moog synthesizer comes in. And that's where any number of electronic kind of sounds. When people tell me that they don't like contemporary music, Mission Impossible, the program I was thinking of. When they tell me they don't like contemporary music, I usually end up saying, "Do you watch Mission Impossible?" "Oh, yes, I love that program." "Good. Then you like contemporary music." Because if you did not have the word track and couldn't see the music, or I couldn't see the action and just listen to the music that goes on in the background of Mission Impossible, it's very contemporary. I mean, they're not afraid to use chords like somebody just got shot. They do not use this for a shooting. Well, there it is, you know, and they kind of, "Oh yeah, I guess I've been listening to contemporary music," you know. They hear it there, but, you know, it hasn't necessarily gone over. When you go home and turn on some kind of a TV program like that, if possible, separate the two. Listen just to the music, you'd be absolutely shocked.
Gee, I've been listening to that. You know, you kind of take it for granted. My last point on contemporary music is only do whatever you can, friends. My personal campaign, which will go until I die, do whatever you can to eliminate Muzak. As a fellow said to me when a dear janitor at Plymouth one Saturday morning, he really is a neat guy, but oh, I came into church and there's this music floating down the hall and speakers at Penny Rector and all of it. And he says, isn't this wonderful? And he says, we can have music all the time now. And I said, no, I don't think it's so wonderful. I went in and I said, and we sat down for a cup of coffee and I said, I'll tell you why. He says, you know, the sad thing about music is it can't defend itself. And I said, you know, music to me is so wonderful that I don't want it every minute of the day. And I said, it really hurts me to know that if I go in a bathroom, in an elevator, in a mall, or anywhere, I can't have silence. I've got to have music always in the background. I said, it really bothers me. And of course, I don't care whether it's Mahler or Rinky Dink going on in the background, it still is there. And it does two things. One, it's there to kind of divert you and kind of pep you up or whatever, you know. But at the same time, it takes away from the quality that music can have, because then when you hear it at another time, and it's supposed to be special, it's not. Because you've been hearing it all the time. It's just been constantly kind of pervading. Now, if you determine to go and put on your record player and listen to a piece of music while you're doing something, that's entirely different. You have control over that. But you have no control when you go into a store and music is playing. And I feel, I don't regard it as being pompous or like I want to, you know, make a show of myself to go up into a grocery store when the music is playing and say, would you mind turning it on? And they, you know, will look at you and I just say, you know, why do you have it on? And obviously it takes a few minutes to do it and once in a while they get very defensive. But sometimes it's so loud, you know, you can't even think. It, you know, there's no volume on it. It's just, you know, it's one or the other. Same thing with my dentist. Now it's down to all the Grinnell's coming in. Quick, you know, off, you know. And when he leaves, on, you know. But okay, but he said, you know, you've got a point. He said, you know, we have people who complain if they can't have something to distract them. And I said, isn't there anything else besides music? You know, why does music, poor thing, have to be the one to distract everybody?
What would you suggest?
I'm not sure. A movie. I don't know, but I'm just saying, you know, it's really a shame that it becomes so commonplace, and that's going to be its worst. It's not going to get better, by the way, friends. It's going to get worse, and that's its worst enemy, is that it will become something that we have with us so much that it no longer is special. And as far as I'm concerned, it's always going to be special. So I'll do what I can. You just don't. Anyway, yeah.
If I understood you correctly, you were using sort of a Hollywood kind of a sound that represented contemporary music, and I don't relate to it at all. I don't think of a Hollywood sound as being the new contemporary music.
Well, it's not new, but it's contemporary in the sense that it belongs in the 20th century.
Yeah. Okay, are you going from there into the what follows?
What follows, I think... in terms of...
Well, let me explain. I think the counterculture generation thinks of that Hollywood sound as being square, not their idea of contemporary at all.
I can't entirely agree with that in terms of some of the songs I hear kids singing in the last 2 weeks.
Really? Mm-mm. My children have been extremely...
The same harmonies that are oftentimes used, though.
Maybe.
Oh, it's lunchtime. I gotta go play for the gang that's going. Yeah.
The new sound is completely different.
I understand that.
Yeah. Okay.
But it's not the but that new sound is not for everybody. By any there is still incredible that like you get Kurt Kaiser arrangements. The arrangers are very smart. They stay with the trends of pop music. And any of the what we'll call the evangelical churches that people are writing music for, sacred music, follow the trends very carefully. And what was used, say, about 1955 or 1960 has all changed. I know this, the ones I've used this morning, I've still heard around, so I know they're still used. But I do know that they have changed, and the arrangers changed right with the trends in pop music. And I'm pointing it out. I'm not saying that necessarily it's good or bad to have in church. We have our own personal preferences on it. And I've tried to keep my personal preferences out of this, because I think when it comes to music, each person, you know, it's like art or any other field, you make up your own mind. But I do find that it's that in some churches, in a quite a large number of churches, it gets used as a substitute for a way of getting around a particular credo of that particular church. What we would do is, for those of you who were at the lecture we did on contemporary music last week, I'd like this to be a continuation rather than a regurgitation of that material, and go on into go on into where I think you might look for music to be going in the next decade or two. As I said in that lecture last Wednesday, one of the fascinating things about contemporary music is that in the 20th century, unlike any other century previous to it, the floodgates were opened wide to possibilities. And whereas in previous centuries you really had a certain limit in within which you had to operate, that no longer became true in the 20th century. And so it is one of the reasons why I think people who listen to music as an avocation, as a layman, are oftentimes perplexed, because there aren't simple ways in which you must listen, but you have to sort of keep your ears open to a whole variety of possibilities. For instance, in the Baroque period of music, 1600 to 1750, roughly, there were very careful guidelines. The mark of a great composer during that period was not that he could work within the guidelines, but that he could make the guidelines work for him. So that someone like Bach, for instance, is great not because he stayed within the guidelines, but in the wonderful ways he maneuvered the guidelines to fit him. At the same time, always being very legal. Bach was not an innovator. Bach was never an innovator, and anybody who says that he started new things is absolutely on going on the wrong trail. Bach was great because he was the person to sum up all that had happened and show you the endless possibilities. You can find in Bach pieces the same chords that came in Richard Wagner a century later, the same stuff that came in Debussy two centuries later, and you could even find 12-tone works in Bach, which is kind of fascinating. For the next return to Holden, we'll do Bach, the 12-tone composer, so that you can see that that's true. But it's fascinating. All of those things were possible, but you see, Bach did not strike out like another composer might have later into new ways and new means of doing things. He was very, very much the legalist in terms of, these are the rules and I'll follow them, but they'll do what I want them to do. And for the next 100 years, that really followed through quite well. Composers did do some more daring things harmonically, but it was not until really the First World War that you had the enormous break with the traditions of the past. You had reached a point, you see, and I just give this little background, even if you were here last week, I think it's good for review. You had reached the point at the end of the First World War where you had gone, where composers had gone about as far as they could go in terms of using scales as we commonly know them. You know, it got to a point where you could say a piece was written in the key of C major, and then you had so many flats, sharps, and naturals added that the piece was, the only reason you could say it was in C major maybe is because you put that down for a key signature. And no longer was it really true. You know, back
I want to keep this simple so that, you know, that if you're not, you haven't had a lot of music background, you can understand all this. But if in a previous century, if you said a piece was in C major, it was in C major. Oh, you might have had a flat occur once in a while, or a sharp, but it didn't occur very often. You really you sat pretty much, you know, if you were doing a piece like later on, you came to a period where, say, you were getting around to the last part of the 19th century, and you might say, we're in the key of C major. I have F sharp, A natural, D double flat, E flat, F sharp. Well, that's, you know, that's still C major, but you see, you've gone a long way. You could say you're in any key. I mean, I can say to you, I'm in the key of F major, and play it in F sharp and just say, well, it's F major, but I added all the sharps. You know, it's like saying, do you walk to work or carry your lunch? You know, I don't know. You reach a point in which, and this was what people resorted and rebelled against, because they reached the point where, you know, well, good grief, you know, you've stretched that whole thing as far as you can. Now, if you're going to go further, you just have to make a complete break. And so when the break was made, and it was made in a number of places almost at the same time, then, consequently, the floodgates were opened. Now, some of the areas that we didn't talk about last Wednesday, that we talked a lot about atonal music, because atonal music, music which does not have any tone center, it is not in any key. When you talk about atonal music, you're really talking about one of the great concepts of the 20th century as far as music is concerned. And many people who don't understand atonal music find it meandering and find it never going anywhere, which is really not true. It is a more of a studied music, except that as soon as I say that, I say, well, so is every other kind of music, because it's only as you study it that you learn and follow and have more appreciation for it. But I think maybe it does need a little more degree of working and looking at it. There was an enormous surge, and we didn't speak of this last week, there was an enormous surge at the end of the First World War to implement and to bring into serious, quote-unquote, music the popular stuff that was being composed. There was a big thing in France to bring in the cabaret songs. Poulenc, that I used the other night, was one of the great ones to bring this. He felt that the music had to have... It was becoming much too esoteric, and people, the common people, were not associating themselves with good classical music because they were finding it too aloof to their needs. And so he was one of those who came in and felt that you had to bring it down a little more onto a level where it still maintained its integrity, but it wasn't quite so aloof for people to catch. And consequently, you had, you know, things that were more... posterity, but because they just wanted to strike out and try and experience something new. One of the big things that took Europe by storm at the in the 20s, of course, was George Gershwin coming over and doing Rhapsody in Blue. Oh my word, you know, that was really, you know, and then Porgy and Bess came along, and American in Paris, and some of the other works in which they made an attempt at, a strong attempt at bringing jazz, which had never, by the classical musician, many of them had always said you could not equate the two. And Gershwin made an attempt to do that, and I think in some of the works more successful than others. The first jazz piece, if you're interested in jazz, if you are a real nut for it, you ought to look at the first piece that brought jazz together with classical music. It's still one of the best pieces. It's called The Creation of the World was written for a ballet by Darius Milhaud, M-I-L-H-A-U-D, who is 80 now, 78 or 80. He is of French origin. He now lives in the United States out in California, teaches at Mills College. And Milhaud wrote this piece, which was just a shocker for people. And it starts off sounding as one of those kind of evocative Frenchy kind of things of the 20s. And it just, you know, it's sort of like, it reminds me a little bit of one of those old gramophones that you had to crank up. And you've already got the needle on when the piece starts. And it really gets going in the middle, you know, and it's really wild. Wonderful piece to listen to. It's for just a small ensemble. It created a real stir. And it still does create a stir when it's really played with a nice flair. People, you know, you have to be a little flexible to it. You can't be really rigid about the piece. And when it gets a real flair to it, it's still a really exciting piece. You had the same kind of thing happening about the same time in Germany with Kurt Weill, who was furious at the way music had become so esoteric and also so scholarly with the Schoenberg School, and it had lost the bite and ping. So he came up with the Three Penny Opera as not only to show his disgust against the music of that period, but also to show his disgust politically with what was happening in Germany around 1929. And however, it was a somewhat disguised form that not everyone caught. And the piece, however, did of course catch on. And one of its only unfortunate things is that the English translations, you may know Three Penny Opera from things like... Mack the Knife song. The only problem with those songs, just a little side anecdote for you, is that the English translations that you have heard of them have absolutely none of the bite that Kurt Weill wrote to them. And it's because it got arranged in 1948 that the fellow who did the translations, and they are the only authorized translations that can be used in the United States, are very pallid. And it is impossible to produce Three Penny Opera in the United States in a translation that does what Kurt Weill said, because this guy's got copyright privileges for 52 years. And it's all worked out with the estate, because we tried. So what you do is you just kind of quietly make the changes and, you know, say that it was spur-of-the-moment performance, you know. It's all you can do, you know. You don't write it in, but you have no other alternative. And, of course, it's those little ways of fighting that it's always a shame. I don't mind when a translation is done that's really good or that says what the piece is. It's sort of like a lot of anthems that have been translated, especially around the end of the century, the 19th century, those Victorian transcriptions of old anthems. They all just took liberties galore. Not that a piece has to be, you know, exactly note for note, if the words don't fit, that you have to use some awkward word. But, you know, I just finished doing an editing of a Mozart motet in which the only edition I knew was one that was done in 1890 by Vincent Novello. And I couldn't believe it when I got the original score. It absolutely bore no resemblance, except they were in the same key. You know, notes all different, text, why we might as well be talking about another whole text. Consequently had nothing to do with the punch and the bite that Mozart had originally written. Well, this happened with Kurt Weill. That's one of the reasons, for instance, why one of the great operas of Europe during all of this period was an opera he wrote called The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, which nobody in the United States, except a few record collectors or people who had gone to Europe and heard the piece, ever knew about. And the reason is because one guy had gotten the rights to do the first American performance back then, and he hadn't exercised his right, and he had a 50-year option. You see, you can do all these kind of things, and of course the piece consequently could be done by no one else in the United States, and wasn't. And unfortunately, now the piece is a little past its prime, and now the rights are out. But now it's like, well, so what? Because it hasn't got the bite that the piece once had. 10 years ago, it would have been a smash. Now, oh, it's still a good piece, but it's just a little over the hill for what Kurt Weill was trying to do. That's not to say that it might not come back and make its point again. So music took a very defensive kind of turn, a lot of people striking out. This happened. The church always was involved in things like this. The church usually is about, I suppose, 30 to 40 years always behind. Something like that, roughly. So whenever any big trend comes, you can count about 30, 40 years later, the church gets involved. You know how you've heard in the... It really wasn't until the 60s, for instance, that anyone ever thought of doing things like the jazz or pop or anything like that and involving it. That stuff, of course, had been ameliorated into the other media back in the 1920s. But about 40 years later, it kind of gets around. So you can kind of figure that, you know, we're composers today are trying more and more to push that gap closer, but I don't know how successful it will ever be. It seems to have always been that way. You know, people complained Bach was writing way before his time, and everybody complained about that awful dissonant Beethoven Ninth Symphony and, you know, all of those kind of things. So it's probably always been that way and will continue. But a few of us will keep trying, you know. You have to keep dragging the church on into the 20th century along with everybody else. It's almost like, you know, sometimes it's the whole point, I think, of providing a means of substantive worship and at the same time maintaining reality rather than substantive worship and escaping from reality. And music sometimes can provide that means of reality that no other can. Music today, consequently, has been opened by these various floodgates. Out of them came the stuff like I was doing the Henry Cowell, and the Henry Cowell business with all the tone clusters led itself automatically into experiencing how could you make different sounds with instruments. For instance, the interesting sound when you mute all kinds of brass instruments is a much different sound to listen to than if they are playing without a mute in the instrument. And they can do various kinds of mutes. And some of those mutes that are now considered very standard were only developed because of needs of jazz performers to get a different flavor in a trumpet. And so they invented the Harmon mute. And now the Harmon mute is a standard kind of mute. It gives you that kind of wah, wah, wah business, you know. But composers will use it today to make very distinct kind of sounds in classical compositions. Now, beyond that came the development then of leading gradually into means that had not been exposed before. The theremin was an instrument that came into being in the 30s concerned with sound waves. And, you know, the nearest equivalent I can give you is the musical saw. You know, you've heard people take a bow over a saw, maybe how they wiggle and goes, you know, that whole routine. Well, that's the way sound waves operate. And through electronic means, they were able to make those waves do what a composer wanted. This is still a relatively new business, and it's a highly technical one. There is a fellow in Paris named Martineau, who invented an instrument called the Onde Martineau, onde meaning wave, and it's the same kind of business. You play it on a keyboard. It's a very long instrument, and you can do different kinds of muffled sounds and very sharp, bright sounds, and it's all played using electronic means and these kind of wavelengths. And Messiaen, for one, has used it to great effect. And it's wild when you've got a full piece. It's incredible how you have a full orchestra playing a big loud moment, and all of a sudden on top of it you can hear this thing going, you know, way up high. And it's sort of an extension of what the instruments that have been around for 200-300 years could do. It was the idea of finding new means of expression, that the ones that we had gone their limit. Other composers, like the Polish composer Penderecki, have gone and experimented with the instruments as they already are, getting the effect, for instance, when the instruments all, the string players, perhaps they're bowing on something, but the eerie sound you get when the players play on the other side of the bridge. You know, when the violin comes out, there's that little wooden thing that sticks up called the bridge, and you always play on the side where the fingers are, the fingerboard. But on the other side of the bridge, you get a really scratchy, eerie sound. And that's one kind of effect that you can get. And composers like Penderecki have used that. There's a piece that he wrote called, or that Lutosławski wrote called Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima, that is for 48 string players and is absolutely overwhelming to listen to. I mean, it's, you know, taken for what it is, it's one of the most striking pieces of the 20th century in the terms of the ground that it struck. It's just horrid. I mean, it's horrifying. It's not horrid to listen to, but it, the images it conjures up are just incredible. It's really a moving piece. If you listen with your ears open, if you listen and expect it to sound like Beethoven, you know, you might as well go home. But if you listen to it for itself, it's a fascinating experience. And it can't be captured on record as well as a live performance. You know, it's all right. But that kind of thing in a live performance is just really an experience to hear. You know, when you all of a sudden have heard all the string players doing, you know, something at the very top of their register, and then at the same time maybe they're tapping on the top of their instrument very softly, and you hear all this tapping going on in the string players, you know. Of course, the worst thing in the world is to get string players to even play this kind of thing. They're the most conservative. They're more conservative than listeners any day of the week. Oh, most conservative members of the orchestra are the string players. Oh, boy, they really are. Strings and woodwinds. Brass and percussion are wild. They're always willing to try some wild thing. And it's very true in every orchestra that is, which there's always a few exceptions, but basically it's always that way. The 7 years I was in the Minnesota Orchestra, you could just, with a few exceptions, always count when a new piece came out, string players, you know, the woodwind players, you know, the brass players, you know, ready to go, the percussion, you know, here we are, you know. And fascinating how that happens, but it just does. This isn't music. You know, the whole routine, you can hear it coming. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, it really takes, in many instances, a conductor who's really going to crack the whip to get those kind of pieces played. Much like I explained when I was talking about Pierre Boulez of the New York Philharmonic last week. You really have to get an incredible person who really knows what is supposed to happen in order to make it work. So there's all those kinds of effects. They're trying to stretch the range. That led into the electronic, as we just mentioned. And the electronic led into electronic machines to produce music. And it's almost to the point now where if you don't listen very carefully, you might not know whether it's an electronic instrument playing or a real instrument. They've gotten very close. They'll never get exact. There's no way they can, because there is no way that an electronic means can duplicate the human emotion. That they can't do. But they can do some fascinating things that right now it's still so experimental. You know, it's an unfortunate thing. So many people have to feel that, you know, the first thing that happens of an experimental nature has to be a masterpiece. My only recourse is to always remind them, you know, if that's the case, why don't we ever listen to the early Mozart works? We admire that you know, he wrote his first symphony when he was six, but we don't ever listen to it. And we admire that Bach was busy writing early, but we don't listen to the early Bach stuff very much. Why should we then feel that a new composer working in a new medium today necessarily has to always have a masterpiece right from the beginning? It takes a while, but at the same time, they've got to have a hearing. You never know until it's live. That's how the composer learns. Obviously, you know, you can sit and practice all day long working on piano pieces, but until you actually perform and listen to it critically in that light, do you know, you know, what you've got to work with or what you're dealing with? My other thing I always say about pieces, that, you know, about someone says, oh, such and such a composer is so uneven. Well, good grief, you know, Bach had days when he had stomach gas too, you know. And I mean, they just aren't all masterpieces. You know, someday I suppose we ought to have a lecture on the duds of Bach, just to dispel a few feelings. He had a much greater percentage of goods than a lot of people, but he had some real dogs. And so did Mozart, and so did Beethoven. And you could spend, you know, hours on those. I wouldn't want to, though. It's a waste of our time. We just know that some of these pieces just aren't so hot. So why bother to play them? Except to learn, you see, oh yeah, he goofed, you know? He missed on this point right over here. Okay, so you get into the 20th century further, and you find that they've come up with, like, the Moog synthesizer. And the Moog synthesizer just becomes an elaboration upon that owned Martineau that was developed in the theremin. It's kind of cute to listen to, and certainly those early experiences gave the instrument a great deal of notoriety by having it be called doing arrangements of Bach and calling it Switched on Bach. And that, of course, had been something in line with when the Zwingli singers had come out and done all of those neat Bach arrangements. They did them so tastefully that you can't complain. They're wonderful. And the same thing with the electronic means. It sort of expanded itself. As I mentioned last night again, it's amazing to me how many people, when they're talking about music, just say, oh, well, you know, of course, that contemporary music, you know, you really just, you can't listen to it, or you can't understand it. They're usually the same people who love to watch all the thrillers on television, which is what really amazes me, and the some of the most creative guys in terms of contemporary music are the guys who are writing for all the TV serials, because the sky's the limit for them. And you know, if you heard Mission Impossible and listened to the background music by itself, you'd probably be a little shocked. And if someone put it on and said, you know, here's a new piece of music, oh, it's another one of those modern compositions. You know, then all of a sudden you put the music, you put some, the film with it, and people go, oh yeah, it fits just perfectly. You know, we are beyond the point where, you know, time for a big, somebody falling out of a window in the 20th century, we see somebody falling, you know, 20 stories flat on the ground, it doesn't make its point quite as well when they fall. If they fall, you know, you're expecting to hear something, you know. Somehow it doesn't make the same point if you went... He hasn't fallen quite as far, you know. And consequently, it's just one of the reasons why composers keep growing, keep trying new things to fit new situations. One of the interesting experiments of that, of course, was when they did the Walt Disney film Fantasia, which I gather is just coming back. You know, it's been shown. I think there's a new edition of it just out. I was too young to see the first one, and I just missed the last one. So maybe it'll come back in another 10, 15 years, I can see it again. I've read all about it and how well it worked, but here they went and used a lot of different means to put together. They used some Bach, they used a prelude, the Afternoon of a Faun of Debussy, and a number of pieces that worked together to form the background for the music. And so the film media has been, you know, a real, one of the great reasons for things going as strongly as they have. I think in the next decade, looking ahead, I want to leave a little time for questions if we can. I think you'll find a few things happening. Obviously, the electronic means has barely begun. For any of you who think, oh, well, maybe it's over soon, don't think that, because it hasn't even started. It is just beginning. Schools of music are just starting to offer courses in electronic music. And I think they haven't even begun to start finding out what that kind of music can do. When I entered the university as a freshman in 1961, they, you know, why, you didn't even know anything about electronic music. It still wasn't even taught. And it was only in about 1965 that they started thinking about, maybe we ought to tell something about, you know, about electronic music, even though it had been around since the 40s. And being developed very slowly, you'll find that it's going to continue. It'll probably take on a much more elevated style. There have been a few examples of it in church music. This fellow, Richard Falciano in Boston, has been fascinated by finding ways in which the organ and electronic tape could get used together. And especially since most churches have a very good speaker system for their minister from the pulpit, they can just plug the tape into that speaker system. And in many cases, what's fascinating is because in a larger church, you know, those speakers are all around the church. Then you just plug the tape in and it sounds like it's coming to you from all over. And a good, interesting tape, but you see, there's a whole thing. There's the number of ideas you can come up with for a tape are just, you know, countless. You can go on and on and on for years and years and years. It's finding the right kinds of sounds that put together to make the tape. Right now, they're really very beginning-ish. If you listen to that P piece, one of the easiest pieces to take if you've never listened to one and you want to understand it right off, is a piece that he wrote called Pentecost Sunday, Come Holy Spirit, for male chorus in unison, organ and tape. And you, I mean, you can hear, you can, it's sort of, if people say, oh, you know, holy, they want to see the Holy Spirit because they grew up in that era when he was called the Holy Ghost, you know, and so that whole ghost routine, you know, gets, it's incredible how people are really stymied about that. That really gets to them still. And, you know, it just, it's incredible how the image of the Holy Spirit takes on a different kind of vista when you hear this tape and this just incredible swirling that goes on. Sounds like a rocket part of the time. In fact, part of it is the taping of a rocket taking off. You know, come Holy Spirit and you're whoosh, the whole thing, ooh, gee whiz, you know. It's incredible and very exciting. There are other pieces that have been written with organ and tape and chorus, or say there's one I know that's just come out with trumpet, organ, and tape. And there's another one called Speaking in Tongues. It's a setting of Psalm 150. And it's called glossolalia. And the tape is, it's for baritone, organ, and tape. And the tape is not so much electronic sounds as it is all kinds of people's voices coming in and out. It's a taped soundtrack of voices doing things. Minnesota Opera, we've been asked to do a tape for one of the New York dance companies, wants to have a background for one of their dances that they do. And they want to have a, they don't want to have an instrumental ballet, they want to have a vocal ballet. All of it sounds, you know, really not the kind of thing that you'd normally associate with the voice. And of course the voice can do some really incredible things too. And so that whole kind of development comes along with it at the same time. I think you're going to find composers continuing to require more and more of instrumentalists technically and more of vocalists. Church music will become little by little, I think it will continue to get up onto a higher level. Not a level, when I say higher level, I don't mean level of intellectual plateau that you can't understand. I just mean that it will take itself on a, perhaps, let's use the word more exalted plane. That it will perhaps be a little more inspiring than embarrassing. I think that's probably the easiest way of thinking of it. I think there are some very valid and great attempts that are being made even now to bring together pop music into classical music that have never been done quite so much. And the reason that they've been succeeding is because contemporary arrangers are so skillful, whereas sometimes before they were kind of embarrassing. The dean of all of these has got to be Leroy Anderson, who did all of those arrangements like Blue Tango and some of the, he did some little silly ones like The Musical Typewriter, and he did Sleigh Bells, and a lot of those earlier ones, but he really did them with such great class that no symphony orchestra could play them and say, oh, this is so poorly done, because it wasn't. It was done very well. Now you've got the same thing contemporary in a contemporary state because you've got, say, Mancini, who does wonderful arrangements that bring out many of the pop tunes. The best contemporary arranger is a guy named Richard Heyman, who is exclusively, and cannot be hired by anybody else, he exclusively has worked for the Boston Pops. And all the best arrangements come out of him. They're just incredible. He'll take any pop tune that anybody's done and give you any kind of arrangement you want. And they are, it just happens to be a very fortunate thing for them. But there are other people who are doing some incredible arrangements out in Hollywood as well. And a lot of these have kind of, you know, started to, the barrier is not quite as distinct as it was between, say, classical music and popular music, or religious music and secular music. It's not quite, you know, when you started having a guitar play in church, the barrier came down just one brick. Because, you know, that had been, oh, well, you know, you hadn't done that before. And then they brought in a drum into the church and another brick fell off.
Two bricks.
You know, well, maybe two bricks because they had the cymbal with it, right. And, you know, little by little, various kinds of differences occurred. It was kind of fun last night. Somebody came up to me afterward and said, you know, by the end of the first verse of As With Gladness, I'd forgotten the other words about Twinkle Twinkle. I didn't even think of that anymore. And it's amazing how fast some of those things can leave you. So little by little, I think these boundaries will continue to come down. At the same time, there is a whole school of music, of which Milton Babbitt and Elliot Carter are sort of the deans, that is the very well-crafted music that, by that I mean, you know, it is intellectually fantastic. It's the kind of thing that the normal concert goer and the abnormal concert goer alike just look at and go, yeah, you know, it would take you months to figure out what the piece is all about. And they continue to go, and that they sort of are in one whole school by themselves. A lot of people look at them and say, oh yes, these are the smartest people in music, so we must perform them. I guess I personally, I have great admiration for them, but I think they've lost reality because they've gone so far. Maybe in another 100 years the human mind will be able to comprehend all of that, but I guess I don't think that it will. And it's music that you can have great respect for, but it's reached a point now of being so technically involved that you just look at it and you go, are you kidding? You know, and to play it, you know, to rehearse it has demanded, made new demands on an orchestra. We did a piece of Milton Babbitt's, and it took us 45 minutes for 3 measures to get it played correctly. You know, what I mean by complex, all right, say the violins, say we've got 3 beats in the first measure. So the violins are going one, but this is the tempo. Say it's 1, 2, 3. And during that, they've got a passage, which is very awkward, perhaps, on the strings, in which the first beat may have 7 notes, the second beat may have 5, and the third may have 13. You know, so you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. And then you want to have 48 players play that together. Okay, so you get that rehearsed. That takes about 15 minutes right there to all get it. Even if they practiced it, doesn't mean anything. Then you've got the same thing, and maybe in the woodwinds, maybe one player is doing a system of 10, 9, 7, and somebody. So by the time you hear that first measure, you've got every rhythmic and note possibility in 3 beats, and it's just, you know. But to rehearse that, it just requires just, you know. We had a wild experience when Babbitt came. The first day of the rehearsal was just horrendous. It was just awful. And you couldn't get anywhere. Everybody, you know, we were all trying, but it was so hard to put the thing together. And it's the kind of thing that's so fragile because, you know, if you goof once, you're just off. And it wasn't going well. And Skowchinski was really mad. And the second day of rehearsal was in the summer. Babbitt was sitting in the 5th row. This is when Skowchinski, who was from Poland, was rather new to the United States and didn't understand some of American ways. And that morning, the generator at the university or whatever it is went out. And all the lights in Northrop, which is a 5,000-seat auditorium, went out. I mean, it was just pitch blackness. We had been in rehearsal 5 minutes, and it had not been going well again. And Skowchinski then just said, very sternly, all right, gentlemen, you think you know it? Now play it. Ooh, in the anonymous darkness, friends, everybody was going, and all, you know, getting out of their system all of this vengeance they had. Skowchinski he expected everybody just to sit there and go, oh, but maestro, we don't know the piece. No, sir, everybody just went hog wild. And the lights came back on and we went, and they all, everybody with a smile, you know, good, got that out of our system. And it was fascinating. Well, 2 things happened. 1, Milton Babbitt walked out. He was furious. But 2, the orchestra played it better after that. They got all of that routine out of their system, and then they sat down, okay, now let's work. I don't guarantee you can do that every time, but it was fascinating, you know, just 1 minute explosion took care of them. Because obviously there had been a great deal of opposition to learning the piece. And a lot of that had just gone out during that minute. And orchestra players are just as human as, and Minnesota Orchestra is one of the nicest orchestras as far as trying new things. Believe me, they are so, they're a dream for a conductor to come in, because they'll just try everything they can to learn. A lot of other orchestras just won't. You know, a Philadelphia orchestra, for instance, one day a conductor was just unmerciful to the cello section, just, you know, about things. And he turned over the violins and was talking to them, and he turned back and the cellos had all gone home. They were all, well, they hadn't gone home, they were all outside. They weren't going to come back in. Brought the manager down, manager had to come to conduct. You know, big scenes, you know. Oh, yeah. We don't wish to be treated quite that way, thank you very much. We are professionals, and we like to be treated like adults, thank you. And when he will apologize, we'll come back on stage. Well, there's two sides to all of these routines, but contemporary music can have a real problem that way. So I think that it will continue much along the same path. I don't see that it will be noticeably changed, the number of new ways. I think in the church, for instance, the biggest change will be that there will be a lot more... I think the church has barely started to try to have other instruments playing in the church. I think there'll be a couple of things. I think there'll be a lot more music written that involves a congregation. The organ was developed for that, just that kind of thing. And for that reason, it can work. Instruments then also is an attempt to make instruments do what they were originally, what are their peculiar qualities. The organ, for instance, has the longest sustaining quality. You can hold a note for, you know, 1 minute or 10 hours. That won't change. So composers are finding that they can use the organ to express that kind of thing, and bringing other instruments in to do what they can do best. A lot of changes that way, very wonderful changes. Music in the concert hall, I think you're going to find more and more concert auditoriums being built to get the audience closer, involved, almost in the round, if not, rather than the orchestra's there, and we're all up here, and creating a barrier of distance. The same thing is true even with concert dress. Concert dress will always be dressy, but I think not quite so formal. And there are a lot of people that are beginning to rebel against it, rebel against the formality of saying wearing white tie and tails. It's just, you know, very outmoded, and a lot of people will not relate to that. That to many people is a real barrier to them. I think perhaps we can change the dress, but I think they're being kind of silly to let that be a barrier in their way. I think if that's the case, then there's other things that are bothering them too. Otherwise, a simple what you wear wouldn't be enough to get you in the way of what the music has to say. And close your eyes. Come in with your eyes closed. You never know what they wear. Come on, nude, you wouldn't even know it, you know? So there are other ways you can go about it. But I kind of think that the complexities that have begun to creep into music will continue, and composers will demand more and more of our ears. And I can only hope that as people listen to music, that they will continue to keep, you know, try and keep a degree of humanness about themselves, not comparing it to any past era, but simply judging it on the merits of its own. Try and remember that, you know, composers are human too. Thank heavens, I think we're getting out of the period in which we all, you know, there was a period around the 40s and into the 50s in which at a concert, the way in which you judged a successful recital was if they didn't make one mistake. Meanwhile, they played nothing. They sat there all night and just played, you know. Well, that's ridiculous, you know. They're human, and I'd rather have a beautifully musical evening and have some mistakes occur along the way. Same thing with recordings. You know, how nice to have a recording from Horowitz, because he always records his mistakes. Didn't make very many of them, but he records them. He doesn't splice them out. It's kind of fun to... you feel a little bit of humanness. It's the same way you feel with, say, Rubinstein. You know, he gets up to play, and... You know, here he is now. Well, his age has varied. Nobody's quite sure. He's anywhere between 85 and 90. And, you know, he gets up to play, and, you know, you first of all just have enormous admiration that he can still play. But it isn't that he can just play, but he plays so well. But he makes no apologies for mistakes. He says, you know, I'm much more concerned with being musical. And I think that kind of sense is becoming more and more a part of the musical life. It... in terms of a pop music, my biggest concern, and it's one that won't come into, I don't think we'll come to any realization of it for another 10 or 20 years at least, one of my biggest concerns is that I think we will have a generation, a part, a minority, but a big minority of a generation coming up that will have distinct hearing loss due to rock music. I have no doubt of it, none. You cannot sit with a loudspeaker as loud as some of the rock groups I have listened to and not have your ears affected. Oh, not now. 30 years from now, well, you know.
Already documented.
Sure. Mm-hmm. You'd be amazed how many more people are going to need hearing aids. There's going to be a new boom in hearing aids. Sad, but there is. Huh?
Hearing aid will always help.
No, I know it. I have a friend who is ear, nose, throat specialist, and he's just sad. He has one of his big parts of his business is rock drummers who come in and can't hear. 19-year-olds can't hear. What's the matter with my hearing? Well, what's the decibel level you've been living at for the last 10 years? It's incredible. Oh, you know, if I have any word for people, I always say, you know, protect your ears. Oh, you know, good grief. It's incredible. The ear can only take so much. Organists. All organists have just a little fuzziness if they play the organ because of the loudness of an organ. I know that. And my organ teacher, who was a fantastic man, who was still playing actively at 82, could not hear the really high, high notes on an organ. I mean, you know, the stuff that's up, you know, which on an organ doesn't have that percussiveness. He couldn't hear those at all. That's one of the reasons violinists, for instance, even in a symphony orchestra, I mean, hearing goes at some point a little bit, but violinists could not, one of the reasons they can't play at beyond a certain age, most of them, is because they can't hear those high tunes and those high pitches. They can't keep them in tune anymore. But it's coming at a much earlier age for a lot of people because they're just, you know, not protecting themselves. And there's a certain, you know, a certain amount of belligerence and defense against it, but boy, it's incredible. You know, you almost wish, and yet this, you know, perhaps would seem partial, you almost wish that much the same way that we outside are saying there has to be a decibel level beyond which mufflers have to be installed, that the same thing had to happen for groups like that, because they will affect so many people. And one of the big problems, I think, in our day and age is that we have too much noise pollution. You know, we're all concerned about the environment, you know, that we can see, but the environment that we hear is just as important. One of the best ways to get kids quiet, like grade school program, it's interesting, I've done a lot of grade school programs, and you go into a school, and, you know, they have a teacher, or they have a principal, usually the principal, if it happens, who has never, you know, understood the neat way you can get kids to learn how to react to quiet, just the way they can react to noise. And it doesn't happen very often, but once in a while. And you go into a school like that, and they're all kind of talking, and you go, hey, kids, do you like pollution? And of course, you know, well, they know that's not good, you know. They're all, no, I don't like pollution. And then you say, you know, there's some people in here that are noise polluters. Oh, look around. You know, you may be sitting next to a noise polluter who doesn't know when he should be quiet. There's one next to me right here, you know, and it's incredible. That'll be one of the big problems also coming up. You know, we talk about music. Music's just a part of it, but a very important part. But noise pollution will be a big source of things. I don't want to dwell on that. It is an enormous problem. And I think in another few years, music keeps going in cycles also. You know, what you emphasize. We had this big era for the 50s and 60s was bring back the Baroque. Now we're into romantic music because the Baroque is very clean, too clean for a lot of people. Now we're into romantic. And Franz Liszt is having his heyday. He's starting to come in very strong. Brahms is going to make another big showing. 5-10 years, Wagner will be back again. Then we will come to Debussy again. It just keeps going around this way, you know. And it does the same thing in music. Pop music does the same thing. What one kind of thing. Right now we're into that medium. We will probably go, I don't know for sure, but we'll probably go from the very loud point to something very, very quiet, in which, you know, the cool thing will be to see how quiet you can listen. I don't, you know, it oftentimes goes from one extreme to the other. And it will go just like fashion does. Everything goes a little bit, you know. And it's fascinating how it gets dictated. You can see where it is dictated and how it happens. And it just kind of goes from one extreme to the other. Kind of watch for it and you kind of smile and go, yeah, here it comes. Yeah. That's what's really kind of fun. You know, you kind of see it creeping over the landscape. And, you know, it's like seeing the mist come in over. Yeah, here it comes. Watch. Oh, here comes the sun. It's going to go away. You know, here it comes again. You just kind of watch it all come and go. And you participate in it while it's there. But if you happen to, you know, the wonderful thing is to be the kind of person as a music listener or as a music performer who has their own ideas and can simply amalgamate what comes in with that particular trend and use it if it's preferable and not use it if it's not and stick to your own. Say, you know, hey, yeah, you know, I love romantic music, but don't forget good old Bach. He was a romanticist at heart. Or, you know, gee, I love the loud rock, but hey, you know, I really like effect created over here. One of the neatest concerts for teenagers that I heard in the last year was held at the Guthrie when they brought in a group called the Mahavishnu Orchestra. And Mahavishnu Orchestra is a very distinct current sound in popular music. And the woman who booked the concert wanted to find a way in which the kids could get turned on to contemporary classical music. And so they did a piece, before the Mahavishnu group came on, they had a few members of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra come on and do a piece by George Crumb, who was a Pulitzer winner in music a couple years ago, Pennsylvania, and I can't think of which of his pieces they did right now. But whatever it was, they had 1,500 kids just screaming because they had to hear it again. And now, since that date, they have not been able to keep it in any of the record stores in the Midwest.